Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Economist.
From The Economist in London, this is Money Talks, a weekly programme about news in the worlds of business, finance and economics. I'm Edward McBride, the finance editor. On today's show, we'll discuss the $8 billion Ponzi scheme that has bilked 900,000 Chinese investors and the relentless spread of negative interest rates around the globe. Here with me to discuss these topics are James Miles, our China editor, and John O'Sullivan, our economics editor. James, let's start with you. Yizhubao, a Chinese peer-to-peer lending company, has been accused of bilking its customers in a Ponzi scheme. That's to say, instead of using money deposited with it to make genuine investments that earn a return, it's instead been paying old investors back with the money deposited by new investors. This sort of scam is distressingly common in China, isn't it?
Well, scams like this, yes, have been bubbling up pretty often over the years. This one, however, is exceptionally large. As you say, 900,000 investors scammed and a total of $7 billion US dollars or more gone missing from this firm. And it comes at a particularly difficult time. And I think that's one reason why the government is so worried about this case, because the economy is slowing. There are worries about weaknesses in the financial system becoming more evident as growth weakens, and a fear that more and more Ponzi schemes will become evident, and particularly in this peer-to-peer lending sector, which has grown very rapidly indeed in the last couple of years. This particular company, just in 18 months, had acquired so-called investments of several billion dollars. And that's because people have very few choices for investment and have piled into these kind of schemes.
Right. As you say, very common, but it's partly common because it's a logical result of the way the financial system in China has been run, right? I mean, banks are now free to set interest rates at the levels they want, but that wasn't true until only very recently. And what that meant, basically, was that Chinese savers had very few places to put their money and earn a decent return.
Well, absolutely. The choices are a roller coaster stock market that's little more than a casino, a real estate sector that, yes, has been going up and up, but there are certainly fears that it too may prove a bubble. Putting your money in the state-owned banking system is hardly attractive. Yes, interest rates have been freed, but banks still hew pretty close to central bank guidelines when it comes to setting interest rates. So along come these peer-to-peer lending schemes. They're offering double-digit rates of return. They're pretty opaque when it comes to who they're lending to. In theory, they're peer-to-peer. In practice, the money is channeled through these firms, which then decide which companies to lend to, and quite how you assess these companies in a system that has very little history of credit rating. It's very difficult indeed. And so, in effect, this has, in many cases, become a rather dodgy and quite possibly, in several cases, giant Ponzi-type operations.
So there's a dilemma here for regulators, isn't there? I mean, on the one hand, we had a story a couple of weeks ago talking about the stats on Chinese peer-to-peer lenders. Out of roughly 4,000 of them, over 1,200 have run into difficulties of some kind. An astonishing 266 peer-to-peer bosses have absconded, leaving their companies in tatters over the past 6 months alone. So, you know, you'd think you'd want to be very careful before putting your money in one of these. On the other hand, there are some big Chinese peer-to-peer lenders. The Chinese government is trying to liberalize finance. Some of them have listed on the New York Stock Exchange or are planning IPOs. You know, how do you
weed out the bad ones without sort of crushing the innovation that Chinese finance so badly needs?
Well, this innovation is very important to China's financial system, and that's why the government has been allowing this peer-to-peer lending sector to develop so rapidly. It wanted to really kind of give the state-owned banking system a bit of a kick up the backside, having existed for so long with the kind of safety blanket of government set interest rates, which guaranteed them profits. But it hasn't introduced the kind of regulation and legislation needed in order to make sure that this market works properly. And belatedly, they've been trying to catch up with this. Toward the end of last year, they introduced draft regulations aimed at making the peer-to-peer lending sector more open. That may work, but it'll take quite some time. This is a hugely opaque system, and that was evident when the Yi Zubao case came to light. They said they had to dig 20 feet underground in order to unearth hundreds of bags full of accounts records from this company. That's the level of opacity that what one assumes is widespread in this industry.
Well, from digging deep underground to find the records of malfeasance at Chinese financial firms to digging ever deeper into negative territory for interest rates, let's bring you in on this, John. It used to be a European phenomenon, negative interest rates. The Eurozone adopted them, so did a couple of other countries. But now Japan has adopted them as well. The scourge seems to be spreading around the world, and indeed the rates are also getting ever lower. How low can they go?
Well, for a long time, it was thought that they couldn't get below zero. And in fact, if you go back to 2009, when the Bank of England adopted quantitative easing, before it did so, it cut interest rates to 0.5% and said it can't go lower because otherwise there's going to be financial stability concerns. And I think that's still a constraint on how far interest rates can be cut. The problem lies with banks. They are having essentially to pay to deposit their reserves at the central bank now in, as you said, in the Eurozone, in Switzerland, in Denmark, in Sweden, and now Japan. So the phenomenon has gone from Europe to being global now. But they can't very easily pass that charge on to consumers, particularly retail customers, who are unwilling to pay to have their deposits resting at the bank. And what that means is that though lending rates come down, that the rates that banks to pay on deposits to customers can't go down. And so that squeezes the net interest margins and thus the profits of banks. So it's putting increasing pressure, particularly on Europe, on banks. In Japan, I have to say, they've tried, what they announced last week, to mitigate some of that pressure by only charging the negative interest rate on a portion of banks' reserves, so the reserves that will be built up subsequent to the announcement. And so at least there is some that takes some of the pressure off the Japanese banks. In Europe, unfortunately for European banks, that's not easy to do, partly because it has some very strange distributional consequences. A lot of the European banks that have big deposits at the central bank tend to be in Northern Europe, and lots of net borrowers in Southern Europe. So you're introducing a kind of country bias if you were to do what the Bank of Japan does in Europe.
So banks are immediately bearing the brunt, but if rates stay negative for a long time, it could upend all kinds of assumptions we have about the way finance and economics works, couldn't it?
Yes. The initial assumption about why rates couldn't go to zero with it was that people, depositors and also banks themselves, would just switch into cash, which is essentially a zero-yielding asset. As it turns out, at very sort of modest negative interest rates, the cost of actually doing that means that banks are happy to continue to pay the charge to central banks. But you can imagine if this goes on for much longer, if interest rates are cut much deeper, then it's not just that people will be looking to switch into cash, they'll be looking to switch into anything that means they can avoid the charge paid to banks for deposits. So, for example, one thing that big companies could do is prepay their corporate taxes or overpay corporate taxes and then claim them back subsequently and then thus pushing the interest charge onto the tax authorities. Now, that was at once a sort of theoretical construct, but we've actually seen some evidence of that already happening. So, for example, one canton in Switzerland, Zug, one of the low tax cantons in Switzerland, has already said it's going to stop incentivizing people to pay their taxes early. And they've come out and actually said we'd rather people pay their taxes as late as possible. And you can think of many other ways in which people could try and avoid find ways of storing cash that avoided the charge on deposits. So using lots of prepaid cards, signing certified checks to themselves and then keeping them in a drawer. And even if you look, if you think about how businesses operate, businesses used to always try to cut their stock levels down. Now you can see them, you might see them increasing their stock levels because the stocks they hold would just be another way of storing value that doesn't incur a negative interest rate.
And not just stock levels, I mean things like paying invoices early, right? I mean the whole world of, you think of big companies trying to pay their invoices as late as possible and meanwhile holding the cash and making a return on that. If cash doesn't earn you a return, right, then the reverse is true, right? You want to pay your invoices as quickly as possible and shove the cash onto the next person down the supply chain.
Right, we just recently had some complaints about big retailers in Britain essentially paying their suppliers too late. But you can imagine them trying to pay their suppliers as early as possible to push off the excess cash onto their suppliers. And you can think of many other examples of how conventions would be turned upside down. You might even think of subscriptions to The Economist or to any other magazine. Usually you get the annual rate you pay for subscribing for several years is much less than what you would pay for subscribing for 1 year. But that might be turned on its head. Companies might be looking for people to subscribe in the short term so that they don't have to have the cost of holding the extra cash.
A brave new world. And it's as I said, this scourge is spreading. Where do you think it might come to next?
Well, I suppose you look around the world and look at a place where interest rates are close to zero. It's actually difficult to implement negative interest rates in America because there is lots of liquid savings are actually held in money market funds and not in banks. So actually for them to charge negative interest is actually quite difficult. But you might look at somewhere like Canada, pretty close to the zero, like lower bound, and its economy is struggling as the oil price goes down, might be one place. I would say just one slight caveat to that, which is that generally what we've seen in Europe, and I think certainly in Switzerland, Denmark and Sweden, is that negative interest rates were introduced as a way of trying to repel money coming into the country and driving up the exchange rate. I think that's probably a consideration in Europe and also in Japan as well. The great symbolism of this is that you now have three of the big post-war savings countries, which is Switzerland, Germany and Japan, are now charging negative interest rates. So look around the world and look at another big surplus country, think of China, and you think possibly that negative interest rates might eventually come to China, although I think there's several steps they have to go through before that happens.
So if that happens, Chinese savers would have more than just financial fraud to worry about. Anyway, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you very much, James. Thank you very much, John. Don't forget, if you want to be a part of the conversation, you can tweet us at EconBizFin and at EconEconomics. You can find our article on P2P lending in China on our website. And in the upcoming issue of The Economist, we'll have a take on negative interest rates. In London, this is The Economist.
The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.